There are, after all, certain advantages in falling in love beneath one's station. For the station of the beloved makes natural turns of phrase which give us pleasure, though he may think little or nothing about them. "Of course," she said, with even more majestic poise, "I do not walk alone. I could never do that. But speak without thought of injury to yourself, for the ears of Hedges and Me'et are as my ears. What would you say?" "Only this, my lady. My responsibilities are more numerous than my years, and it could not have surprised your servant had not alone goodwill, but some ill-will and contrariety accompanied my swift rise to the steward's office. I had a father who brought me up in the goodness of his heart, the Osiris Montcalm. Would that the hidden one had let him still live, for much better was my youth, and I might still speak of good fortune when I was his mouthpiece and his right hand. But he has entered the mysterious gates to the splendid places of the Lords of Eternity, and I am alone with more cares and sorrows than the tale of my years, and have no one in the world with whom to take counsel in my unripeness, or to share the burden which bows me to the earth. Petipre, my great master, may he live long in good health, is well known to take naught upon himself, save that he eats and drinks and boldly confronts the horse of the Nile. When I come before him with the accounts and books, he will say, 'Good, Osarsif, my friend. All that you have written seems to me right, so far as I can see, and I take it that you have no intent to cheat me, for you know the nature of sin, and have understanding for the special offense to me which would lie therein, and therefore I need not trouble myself.' Thus the master in his greatness, may blessing be upon his head." He searched her face for a corresponding smile. It was a very slight treachery which he here committed, an attempt, though in all love and respect, to set up an understanding with the mistress over Petipre's head. He thought he might go so far without offense to the bond. He still thought, for some time yet, that he might without danger go so, and so far, but there was no smile of understanding. And he was glad to see that, though faintly ashamed. He went on, "So am I alone in my youth and unripeness, with my many problems of trade and production, of increase and maintenance. As you saw me approach, my head was full of the cares of the sowing, for the river ebbs, and the beautiful feast of morning approaches, when we dig the earth and bury the god in the darkness, and plough for the barley and wheat. Then here is the problem which goes round and round in my head, for it is a question of a change. Whether we should not do well to sow much more dura corn on Potiphar's fields, which are the island in the river, instead of the barley, as heretofore. It is the Moorish millet, the negro corn, the white kind, for we have already planted plenty of brown dura for fodder, and it satisfies the horses and is good for the cattle. But the question is, would it not be an improvement to change over to the white to even greater extent? That is, planting over much ground to feed the servants, that they may be nourished by good bread instead of with lentils and barley, and grow stronger in their service. For the kernel of the white corn is full of meal, and has taken up the richness of the earth, so that a worker needs less than of the lentils or barley, and we feed them quicker and better. So all that goes round in my head, I cannot tell how. And when I saw you, my lady, approaching through the sunset garden with your handmaids, then I thought in my soul and spoke to myself as to another, 'Lo, you are alone in your unripeness with the cares of this house, and have no one with whom to share them, for the master takes upon himself none of these things. But now comes the mistress in her beauty, followed by two maids, as is fitting to her rank. Confide, then, in her upon the matter of the new plan and the dura corn. Try her opinion, and her good counsel will sustain your unripe youth.'" Annie blushed, partly for joy, partly for embarrassment, for she knew nothing at all about negro corn, and was ignorant of the advantage of planting it. She said, in some confusion, "The matter is worthy of discussion, that is clear. I will consider it. Is the soil of the island favorable to this innovation?" "The mistress," remarked Joseph, "displays her judgment and experience. in that she seizes at once upon the heart of the matter in all things. The soil is fertile enough, yet one must be prepared for failure at first, for the field workers do not yet know how to sow the white corn for food, but only the brown for fodder. What does my mistress think that it may cost till they are instructed in the fine cultivation of the ground with the hoe, as the dura requires, or till they understand that it cannot tolerate weeds like the brown? For if no heed be paid to the roots and shoots, then there is fodder, but no nourishment. You may well have your difficulties with your workpeople in their lack of understanding, said she, and went red and pale with embarrassment, for she knew nothing of these things, and had no sensible answer ready, though she had wished that he might speak with her about them. Her conscience smote her with shame before her servant. She felt humiliated, for he spoke of honest practical matters like food for human beings, whereas she knew and desired nothing but that she loved him and longed for him. "It must be very difficult," she repeated, and controlled her trembling. "But they say that you know well how to deal with the laborers and keep them to their work, so that you will surely succeed in teaching them this new thing as well." His gaze betrayed that he had not heard what she said, and she was glad, though this was at the same time an offense. He stood there plunged in his practical considerations. "The straw from the corn is very strong and pliant. It makes good brushes and brooms, so that it is not all loss should the crop fail." She was silent, painfully conscious that his mind was not on her, but on the brooms, which was certainly a more honorable topic than her love. But at least he noticed her silence, for he started and said with that conquering smile, "Forgive me, my mistress, that our converse is upon such lowly themes as can but bore you, but it is on account of my single-handed unripeness in these cares, and because I was so tempted to take counsel with you." "There is naught to forgive," she answered. "The matter is important, and the possibility of making brooms lessens the loss. I thought so at once when you spoke of your new plan, and I will also consider the matter further." She could not stand still. Her feet urged her away from him and his too dear nearness. All lovers know this conflict, the strife between seeking and flight, and old as the hills is the practice of speaking honesty with the tongue, while the eyes belie it with their seeking, shifting glance, and the mouth writhes what it utters. Fear lest he know that her talk about corn and brooms concealed only one desire, that she might put her hand on his forehead and kiss him with possessive maternity, the frightful wish that he might know it and not despise her for it, but rather share her wish. These, and her great uncertainty in all pertaining to food and fodder, which was the subject of their talk, for her but a lying pretext, though how can one lie when one has no knowledge of the pretended subject and is condemned to stumble blindly through it, all these unnerved and shamed her so that she went hot and cold and could think only of panic flight. Her feet twitched to be off, her heart held her still on the spot, in the immemorial struggle of the love possessed. She drew her mantle closer about her and spoke in a strangled voice, "We must continue, steward, another time and in another place. Evening is falling. I shall soon be shivering with cold." She was, in fact, taken with an unmistakable shivering, which she thought to explain on this ground. "You have my promise that I will take counsel of myself as to your new plan. Likewise, I permit you to come before me again when you feel yourself too solitary in your youth." She should not have tried to utter this last word. It stuck in her throat, for with it he and only he became the subject of their talk. It was a stronger synonym for the you she had used in their lying converse, the only true thing in it. It was the word of the magic he practiced, the word of her maternal longing, laden with tenderness and pain. It overcame her quite. It died away in a whisper. "Farewell," she breathed, and fled, her maidens ahead of her, past Joseph as he stood bowing in respectful salutation.